This is some early stuff too. Fred Durand Glider Repair was a place that repaired gliders, and the inspiration that I got to do the moldless composite structure, and that is the way the very easies were built, and long easies and so on, a lot of other ones, is I watched these people repair broken European sailplanes, and they did it without the factory tooling. And what they do is they put the core back together, and then they'd skin the inside and outside, and they repaired it that way. And I got to thinking, well, hell, you could build a whole airplane that way, and you wouldn't need tooling.
Wow.
And Gary Morris worked there, and he would come over every night while I was building the very easy, and I paid him by feeding him dinner. And he would come over every night and help me build that.
When you had those sessions with the pilots, did you learn anything from them?
Oh, of course.
That allowed you to redesign stuff later?
Absolutely. That was the most important reason to be at Oshkosh, is to see what the user is running into.
Yeah.
And to understand how smart or dumb they are. Because if you design an airplane and you don't call that right, it could be real serious. Long easies and very easies today are built by thickening the epoxy with cotton. The original very easy was thickened with asbestos fibers. And yeah, we didn't wear dust masks, and yeah, we'd sand it and breathe it. And duh, it didn't do anything to me.
Oh, man.
It was also done with aircraft spruce had to eat all of that.
Yep.
And we agreed that we shouldn't ship this out. We don't know if this is a true scare or not, but we quickly found that we could use cotton. Also, the 7081 cloth, I had worked with imported cloth, which made it easy enough for the home builder to build that. And it wasn't made in this country. And they went to Hexcel, which weaved the cloth, fiberglass cloth, and they said, no, we can't just do that for you. You'd have to put in an order for $100,000 of material before we would set up our mill to do that. And I went back to Aircraft Spruce, which was a small company at the time. And I had a little meeting with Flo Irwin. And they made a contract, and they committed to buying $100,000 of fiberglass. And that was before the plans were out. So that was an enormously courageous thing for them to do.
Wow.
Okay, let me go on. Let's look at the next slide real quick. This was done in Australia. In 1977, I realized that I had to teach the world how to hot wire and how to mix epoxy and how to work with flock and how to do flock corners, how to do epoxy layups, how to stipple, how to do all of this stuff because people didn't know. People built boats, but that wasn't good enough. Okay? And I went to 10 countries and taught people how to do it in these kind of demonstrations. There's a couple of Aussies doing a hot wire cut there. And I went to EAA chapter meetings. I went to Norway, went to France, Germany, England, Australia, New Zealand. What a whole big list. I went to 10 countries. And I'll tell you the interesting thing about it. I had to bring all the materials with me. And I put my clothes in one suitcase, and I put all this equipment in the other suitcase. Now, the equipment included plastic bags filled with white microballoons. And during all that travel, twice, the version of TSA that we had then asked to open up one of my bags, and they never asked to open up the one with plastic bags filled with microballoons. Okay, next slide. You probably can't see it close enough to identify him, but this was taken in 75 or so, and there's some people that you might recognize there. Go on to the next one. This was a surprise birthday party that they gave every 5 years for Dick and I, because we're 5 years apart. Now, it's hard to say it's a surprise birthday party if it happens every 5 years. But we weren't supposed to know about it. The reason I know that this was in... when I was 55 and Dick was 60, is there's a boomerang in the picture. So I've got all these pictures, and I can tell by the airplanes that are in it whether it's earlier or later than that. But it's really cool to go out on the ramp and see all these airplanes that look alike. And they all flew there in order to celebrate my birthday and Dick's birthday. And I just thought that was so cool. Next slide. And this is Mike Melville. He said he didn't live in a desert. Here he is with a wind-blown hair, and I hope you can see how young he is there. Next slide. This is the formation of the small and the regular. Very easy. Next slide. Oh, okay, I talked about Mike living at RAF in the waterbed. I wasn't an environmental guy, but I was a technology guy. And I wanted to try this method of doing hot water that didn't require a pump or valves. And if you put the tank real high and the collector real low, it circulates on its own. So Mike and I are out there in 19, you know, a lot of people, the greenies, when they see this, it drives them nuts because they think I'm one of them. But I did solar research there, and we had solar hot water heat in RAF in 1978.
Yeah.
And remember how many showers you could get out of that for your family?
Yeah, not too many. Hey,
can we go back to the slide just before that?
Yeah.
And I want to point out something that probably a lot of people don't know. You see that thingy on the end of the wingtips? We call it winglets. That was developed by NASA, or NACA, by Dr. Whitcomb. And he gets credit for it. But maybe something you don't know, but the very first time that those things ever flew, and he was able to use the winglets to improve the efficiency of the wing, and then being very clever, he also used it for directional control. So he got two things out of one. But he's the very first one. And NASA would say, boy, don't tell Bert anything about some stuff, because he'll go out and try it. Well, and maybe it won't work.
I don't know about that. But anyway, the article came out in Aviation Week in 1974, I think December, that Dr. Whitcomb at Ames Research Center had developed this thing that lowers the induced drag and doesn't put as much bending on a wing. And it's this thing, a top and bottom little winglet thing. And I copied that shape. Now somebody told Dr. Whitcomb, there's an airplane already flying with your invention. And he says, well, who did it, Boeing or Lockheed? And they said, no, some guy in a little shop that builds plastic airplanes. And he says, well, he wouldn't know how to do it. He probably doesn't know how to shape it to get the benefit for he actually said that he wouldn't know how to properly use a winglet. Okay, and I got that feedback. You know, I have spies everywhere. I worked for the government for 7 years, remember? 2 years later, Dr. Whitcomb himself comes to Oshkosh, and I took him out to the flight line, and I showed him the winglets on the Very Easies, and he apologized on the spot. He says, these are designed exactly for the criteria that I intended to optimize the untwisting of the tip vortex, and he right to my face apologized for making those comments, and that really made me feel good. Yeah. You know, he was a very famous theoretician, aerodynamics, and he actually put his blessing on the fact that we flew his things, and he was happy because it was a long time before you found him on Lear jets and airlines.
Big deal.
Oh, on the way to Oshkosh, Sally was flying the Long Easy, Mike was flying the Very Big, and I was flying the Defiant, and we're trying to get over the Rockies, which is real hard to do in a Very Big. And we decided that we're going to land in Aspen. Now, Aspen, I don't know how many of you landed in Aspen, but it's kind of tricky. And Mike and I came in real fast, and we floated way up the runway, and we went almost to the end, you know. And Sally put it on the numbers and made the first turn off. And she told us about that for a long time. Okay, next slide. Okay, this photo was top secret. It was locked in a safe for decades. It's a Starship with its nose on the ground, and it's grazing with a Very Easy and a Long Easy. What would you have thought if Beechcraft knew that we had done this? You know, what they didn't know is the first time a full-scale Starship came to Oshkosh, it was parked over there about 200 yards the other side of the Brown Arch. We had a plan that we'd come out at 2 in the morning and take two mattresses out of the bed from our hotel, and we'd figure out a way to retract the nose gear only, and we were going to set it down on its nose on the mattress. And then we kind of looked at the upsides and the downsides of that and decided not to do it. But this is as close as we came. The next slide was also top secret, and that is we have this beautiful formation photo with a starship, Defiant, very easy, long easy. You know, here's the canard airplanes of their day. And Beach never wanted us to be related to the home builds. They never called those winglets. They were tip sails.
Tip sails.
They never called that a canard. It was a forward wing.
Right.
Well, I'm proud to say I got to ride in an airplane with winglets and a canard starship to Oshkosh this year. And thanks. Is Robert Shearer here? Yeah, Robert. Robert, shut up. Let me talk to him. I want you to go out and look at his airplane. It has a new paint job, and it is prettier than it came out of the factory in Beechcraft in the 80s. Also, Robert Soley is responsible for keeping those airplanes flying. He went up and bought up the spares that Beech had. They were going to destroy them so nobody could maintain a starship. And he assures me that he can keep starships flying for a couple hundred years.
The moon is out, so are the mosquitoes. It must be summer in Wisconsin. Welcome back to Theater in the Woods on EAA Radio.
Closet, we transferred the contract over. It was a RAF project at first.
Okay, but Beechcraft paid for it.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, now they paid for this thing. And you can tell us how much they paid them or you don't want to. But I remember it took just a handful of months, like about 6 months from concept, from Bert drawing it all up and had this idea until it was ready to fly. Now, I was really excited about this. We hadn't done turboprop airplanes, and this is a twin-engine turboprop, and he's got these canards when you take off or like this, and they sweep back. I thought, wow, this is going to be really cool. But then, evidently, Beechcraft got cold feet about this airplane.
No, Beechcraft got some wind tunnel data that showed that the Starship would rotate.
No, I was going to tell him that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Stand by here. I'm telling you how I remember it.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, they went out, and I guess they got cold feet. And they went and built a little aluminum starship and put it in a wind tunnel. And they decided, for whatever reason, that it wouldn't fly and it was dangerous and it was going to crash on the first flight.
They just said it wouldn't rotate. It'd run off the end of the runway.
Okay. Yeah. So anyway, on this day, we were just about ready to fly the airplane. We had got it all ready and we're going to do the first flight on this airplane. And these three suits, you know, if somebody shows up in a suit in Mojave, we all grab our wallets. So anyway, these three suits show up. Now they're big engineers, see? And, you know, I'm not the engineering type, but Bert is talking, and they're laying out their data on the ground, and they says, oh, God, you haven't flown it yet, have you? Oh, God, we got here just in time. Here's what we found in the wind tunnel, and please do not fly the airplane. We just, you know, we got here in time. We're going to save your life. And they're looking at me and thinking, God, I'd save Dick's life if we did this stupid wind tunnel that costs more than the real airplane. And so Bert's standing there, and he's really cool, and he keeps kind of looking over their data like this. He kind of did his chin like that, and he, in front of these guys, that they came out here and thought they just saved our life and saved the whole program. And Bert looked at him, and he looked at it, the data for a minute, and he did his chin, and he says, nope, you're wrong. Dick, go fly the airplane.